Dear friends, thank you very much for inviting me. It's nice to be in Vancouver on a sunny day. Because I was telling friends here that every other time I've been to this city, it's been raining. And when people point out it's really very beautiful, it's great, I've never quite believed it, but today I do. Let's see what has changed in the world since we last met. And that means starting with a war which people would like to forget. And I've just got here from a nearly two and a half week tour of the United States. And there were very large audiences. But the feeling overall you got in the United States was that this was a country which did not know it was at war. And the way that war is portrayed in the media is very episodic. And unlike 30 years ago, when the entire country knew they were fighting a war in Vietnam, like it or not, this time there is passivity, there is demoralization because of Bush's re-election, and you don't get the feeling that people are really aware that it's a war and that U.S. troops should be withdrawn immediately from Iraq. I hope it will pick up, but certainly that was one of the themes that we discussed in the United States. Now, the way the war in Iraq is being presented today, they failed in everything else. All the reasons that they gave for the war have now been conclusively proved, and it has been demonstrated that they were lies. That the leaders of the Western world who supported the war lied. And the reason they lied was to convince their publics that it was essential to go to war. So having failed to convince people with all the lies, what they are now saying is, ah, yes, but we have introduced freedom and democracy to Iraq. So let's discuss freedom and democracy in Iraq and what state we are at. First, Iraq is a country under occupation. Hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers litter the streets of most of its cities. These soldiers come largely from the United States and Britain. The third largest force in Iraq are what in the old days we would describe quite bluntly as mercenaries. But in today's world, where language itself has become debased, they are referred to as defense contractors. But these defense contractors are essentially privatized soldiers, mercenaries, hired by the United States to make up for the default in its own army. They need more soldiers, but there's a decline in recruitment, because it's a volunteer army now. It's not an army which has been recruited by a draft through conscription. And so they depend on people to join the army. And since the war in Iraq began, recruitment figures have fallen drastically for the land army, for the US Army. For the Air Force, they're still pretty high. But people don't want to go and get killed. They don't mind killing from the air when no one can touch you because no one else has that air power. But once you invade a country and occupy it, you can get killed, as they're finding out. So recruitment is right down. And so the contradiction of the United States is how to hold Iraq with such a small force. They never thought it would be small, but it has now, it looks very tiny compared to the population of that country. And mercenaries aren't capable of doing the trick. And they go far afield to recruit mercenaries. A US sergeant 6 or 7 months ago was captured by the Nepalese guerrillas and held captive. And they said, what are you doing in our country? And he said, I'm here to recruit people for the Iraq war. They said, you're very lucky we're going to let you go. You have no business being here. They recruit from South Africa. I don't know how many of you know that there are dozens of South African whites from the old torture brigades of the apartheid regime who are now fighting in Iraq. One of them, I was in South Africa about 8 months ago, One of them, who participated in the torture and killing of Steve Biko, had been killed in Iraq. And I remember some South African friends saying to me, thank God the Iraqis don't believe in truth and reconciliation. Someone's dealt with this guy. So the question is, can they carry on in this fashion? And a lot will depend now on what happens over the next 6 months. So you have a half-baked, rushed election in which no one who publicly demands the withdrawal of United States troops and the occupation armies from Iraq is allowed to appear on television. The Shia parties or the Shia blocs that won the election were forced to give a press conference before these elections to say that they were not in favor of a US withdrawal. The Kurdish tribal leaders publicly said they want the United States to stay. Now, what is strange about this is that the Shia bloc, which participated in an election under an occupation, hoping this way to come to power, which they have, but its power very restricted, because the only force in the country which defends that power is an occupying force. So it's limited. But they know one thing perfectly well, that the overwhelming bulk of the Iraqi population wants an end to the occupation. So 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks ago, you had the largest mass gathering in Iraq for 30 years. You had over 250,000 people marching in the central square in Baghdad, demanding an end to the occupation and burning effigies of Bush and Blair. So what price an election designed to supposedly stabilize a country? That's the question we have to ask. And in my opinion, it is not going to stabilize the country. And the reason it isn't going to stabilize the country is because the country is occupied. Just imagine if during the occupation of France by the Germans during the Second World War, when actually there was more support for the Germans in France than there is for the United States in Iraq, if the truth be told, at least 50, if not 60% of the French population went along with the occupation because they weren't particularly affected by it initially. And it took the French resistance 3 years to grow, and it was created by the British as part of the fight of the Second World War between the different powers. In Iraq, no outside power intervened to form the resistance. It was an internal resistance, and it grew up very quickly. But just suppose that the Germans had organized a referendum, which was their favored method in those days, and the bulk of French people had voted for a German occupation in that referendum. Who would have taken it seriously? Even though it would have been probably much more serious than anything in Iraq today. So one has to look at these things both in historical perspective and what it means concretely to be an occupied country, and how you react when you are an occupied country. And the fact is that unlike the German occupation in France, for most people, not Jews and communists, but for most people, the system worked. Everything was fine, food was available, the cafes functioned, the theaters were there, the cinema was there, more movies were made. In Iraq, nothing functions. Nothing. The electricity doesn't function in many cities, the water supply has been cut off, the hospitals don't have enough medicines. The situation is chaotic, and it's a savage chaos. And the only thing which seems to function as before is the Abu Ghraib prison, where tortures carry on. And one awaits for some warmonger ideologue in the West, and I'm sure it will happen, because politics these days outpaces satire. I'm sure we will soon have a book from someone, probably some well-paid academic on an American campus, who will write on how democratic torture is in fact more advanced than totalitarian torture. wait for it. It will happen. It will happen. Because in behind the scenes, these debates are taking place in the American Academy. And if you look at the time it took, these professors, you know, there's a new development on the American Academy, in the American Academy. Don't let them mimic it here, by the way, unless it's already happened. But a new post has sprung up, which is Professors for Human Rights Studies. And 90% of these professors for human rights studies tend to be those who support US wars abroad. So the linkage between human rights and US wars abroad is very clear. They defend them, they justify them, they become their ideologues. They were posed a problem when the tortures at Abu Ghraib became very public. What to do? Because it takes even a human rights professor appointed by the Academy a bit of time to work out some explanation for this. Because human rights here are being clearly violated. And they hummed, and they hawed, and there was a lot of hand-wringing that went on. And finally, after 2 weeks of serious thought, Michael Ignatieff came out with an article on the New York Times op-ed page saying it was difficult to justify these tortures. Well, thank you. So this is the world in which we live, where US power is so strong that it affects the ideology in a very, very sharp way, much more so than it did in the past when you had a diverse world. In the 60s and 70s, in the early 80s, you had a world in which you had different states with different social systems, which may have been defective in many ways, but which at least enabled a large margin of space to exist. Today, that world is gone. You have capitalism in virtually every other country of the world, in every country of the world, with the exception of Cuba and partially Venezuela, where a new process is beginning. But in this situation, the ideologues also have become much more shrill because they feel they don't have to debate with anyone. And the effect that this has had on the media of the Western world is very noticeable. I don't live in this country and don't visit it that often, so I can't comment on it, but some of you may do so. But I visit the United States a great deal, and I spend a lot of time in Britain. And there you see very clearly what has been happening. In the United States now, within the mainstream media, there is no diversity allowed. No anti-war voices are permitted. Forget Fox television. People sometimes say to me, if the Third Reich had a television system, would it be like Fox? And I said no, because they were better propagandists, the Germans. They wouldn't be so crude. I don't talk about Fox. I talk about the mainstream networks and the stuff they churn out. And it's frightening. It's frightening. And this is the reason why in the United States there's been a gut response from a minority to produce alternatives. This is why Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Is heard and watched by 2 million Americans every morning, all over the United States, and it's going up slowly, because she presents an alternative view, which even people who might not agree with everything on her program want to hear that opinion so they can make up their minds. And in Britain, what did we see? We saw a rigged judicial inquiry into the Iraq war, where they appointed a bench judge, who produced a bent report. They used the bent report to attack the BBC for its coverage of the war, and Tony Blair personally authorized the sacking of the chairman of the Board of Governors and the Director General of the BBC, both new Labour appointments, because they had let the government down in their reporting of the Iraq war. And the Director General of the BBC has now written his memoirs. He's not a bad guy, but he is illiterate, but he can't write particularly well. But there are some gems in that book. And one of the gems is his exchange with Blair, when Downing Street in the run-up to the war was ringing him up every day. and saying, why have you got this? Why have you got X? Why is a current affairs show got audiences which are totally anti-war? And he would reply, because that's all who, you know, applies to come to these things. So they then went and found him tame Iraqis to put in these audiences who would defend the war. And when the big demonstration in London took place, and 1.5 million people marched through the streets, the biggest demonstration in British history, and the BBC was reporting it 24 hours coverage from the beginning to the end of the demonstration, and some of us were interviewed for 20, 25 minutes on this live television program. Downing Street, we later found out, was on the phone 5 times that day, with Blair's head of press saying, the BBC is reporting 1 million people on the march. How do you know? Have you counted them? And the Director General of the BBC says, no, we haven't counted them, but this is the official police figure, so ring up Scotland Yard if you want to have the figures ring. The demonstrators are claiming 1.5 million. I'm just pointing this out to you as examples of how desperately important the media has become for them.